The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. What I'd like to do this evening is to tell you a series of stories that each of them, which has a verse, an ancient Buddhist verse from the time of the Buddha, from the Dhammapada. And I'm hoping that by the end of the evening, you'll have memorized the verse. And that it's not working for you? It's not working for the people with the hearing system devices? Yes. It's working for their devices. So let's see. Is it working now? Great. Okay, so I'd like to tell these stories with this verse, and by the end of the evening you'll have memorized the verse, and also you'll maybe can imagine an occasion or occasions where you might want to use it. So I told some of these stories yesterday on Sunday morning here, and when I finished teaching, a man came up to me who knew this verse, and he said, this verse was actually very important in the early 1950s in San Francisco. And he told me this story that in 1951 there was the San Francisco Peace Conference. 38 countries from around the world gathered in San Francisco to discuss what was supposed to happen with Japan. Japan had lost the war. Japan had been conquered, and generally, when countries, if you go back over the millennia, when countries get conquered, especially ones that have been aggressors, it's not so pretty for what happens. And so they were gathering together to discuss what was supposed to happen to Japan. And a very important part of this discussion was how much autonomy to give Japan. There were some people who felt that Japan could not become a free nation again, because it was too dangerous. They'd militarize again and attack. So there was a lot of discussion about what was supposed to happen to Japan. And there were controversies. These different nations had different ideas. And dividing up Japan apparently was one of the options, and different things. And so in this meeting, maybe somewhat contentious meeting, the foreign minister from Sri Lanka stood up and gave a speech. And one of the things he said was that Sri Lanka, Japanese had not invaded Sri Lanka during the war, but apparently it had bombed Sri Lanka and done a lot of damage. And he said, Sri Lanka is not going to ask for reparations. We don't want any kind of compensation for the damages done to us, because Japan is in ashes, poor country, and we would like to see it be able to get back on its feet. And then that's kind of, generous act. And then he recited a verse, this verse I want to teach you tonight. And the way it was told to me yesterday was that when that verse was recited, the whole room got calm. And then the finish of the speech, which was apparently got universal applause, the conference decided that that Japan would become a free country, and there would be no restrictions in Japan. It would allow it to become a nation again, and that some of the restorations and some of the reparations that maybe needed to happen would be discussed between country to country, free country to free country, rather than forcing Japan to do it, as they had the ability to do it. And we know in some ways it was a great success, that what happened to Japan after World War II, in the sense that they were able to recreate themselves into a successful country, and they weren't dragged down from the damages from the war. It's a remarkable thing, I think. So this foreign minister from Sri Lanka stood up and talked about this, and in the process of it, he talked about the teachings of his great teacher, the Buddha. And he said, hatred never ceases with hatred. By love alone does it end. This is the ancient truth. And that was the verse that calmed everyone down. So it's a remarkable story that this somehow, the speech and that chanting that verse was a turning point for this international conference. And it's a little bit hard to believe, but in fact, after this man told me this yesterday, Nikki Mirgafori, who teaches here sometimes, was here, and I told her the story, and she said, "Oh yes." What the man said was that told me this, that in Tokyo there's a plaque with this verse on it, commemorating how important this was for the Japanese nation, and that this foreign minister, what he did for Japan, and there's a plaque. So I told Nikki Mirgafori this story, and she said, "Oh, 25 years ago, before I really knew anything about Buddhism, my first encounter with Buddhism was that plaque in Tokyo." It's kind of nice, huh? And her first encounter with Buddhism was, hatred never ceases with hatred. With a love alone, it ends. This is the ancient truth. Some years later, there was, in the 1970s, there was killing fields of Cambodia. And many people fled Cambodia into the refugee camps on the border between Thailand and Cambodia. And there were these very large refugee camps with hundreds of thousands of people in them. And almost all the Buddhist monks who lived in Cambodia were all slaughtered in the killing of Cambodia, genocide. And but there was one monk who was practicing and studying in Cambodia monk in Thailand, and so he didn't die. And that was a wonderful man named Mahagosananda, who went back to Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge was taken out of power and helped restore Buddhism in Cambodia. But he was living in Thailand, so he made the travels to go visit one of these refugee camps. And when they got to the camp, he was helping people, or the people, they built a platform in the middle of the camp where he was going to sit and address the assembly. And the people building the platform in Mahagosananda were threatened by death by the people somehow connected to Khmer Rouge, who somehow had infiltrated or were kind of in the picture somehow. But they went ahead and built this platform. And when he got up on it, and apparently tens of thousands of refugees came and sat around as he was going to address them. And these are people who had their families killed in Cambodia. Probably some of them had their entire families killed, and their only people survived. The country was destroyed. There were tremendous atrocities committed. That some of them had seen that, and they came in the refugee camp. So that was the context for Mahagosananda getting up on the stage, and he started chanting. He chanted over and over again, "Hatred never ceases with hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth." And the people in the crowd started crying. And not my imagination, what I assume is they were tears of healing. Hearing Buddhist teachings, hearing this kind of message, hearing it at a time of great trauma and fear and trouble, it probably had some kind of cleansing effect to be reminded of these teachings. So then we go back to more ancient times, and there's a story that is told that there was a great king of India. He was supposed to be the first emperor of India, who united, is probably a polite way of saying it, a large part of northern India, and big first kind of empire of India. And he was known to be quite a cruel king. And he went through and, conquered the neighboring countries. And in the process, there were apparently some pretty gruesome battles. And the ancient records say there was one battle where, on his battlefield, where something like there was 100,000 dead soldiers and fighters and things. And dead and wounded were laying there. And the day after, the next morning, he went out, the king went out and walked across the battlefield and saw the carnage. You can imagine what it's like. And I've been told, I was told yesterday, because I told the story, that one of the most expensive films made in India was a story of this king. And in that movie, there's this story of the carnage and him walking across the field is there. And but across the field came a solitary Buddhist monastic walking calmly and peacefully through the carnage. And the contrast between this peaceful, calm monastic and the violence that was displayed all around apparently got the king's attention. And he went over to talk to the monastic and say, What are your teachings? What do you follow? How is it that you're so calm or something? And the monastic said, hatred is never overcome. Hatred is never ceases by hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. And then with that encounter with the monastic and hearing those teachings, King Ashoka was made a kind of transformation. And then he became known as one of the most righteous kings of India. He went from being one of the cruelest to one of the who instituted all kinds of policies in order to help the people and animals, built wells and bridges, and did a lot of things that he's still known for what he did. And if this story is true, then that verse turned him. Go back a little bit further, and there's a story of the Buddha saying this verse. And in this story, there's probably a myth, is that the Buddha belonged to a small country, tribal republic called the Shakya, and the neighboring country was out to attack it, conquer it or something. And so the army came, and the Buddha heard about this, so he walked out to the border, and he sat down in the middle of the road, where the border is. And sitting in the middle of the road meant he was sitting in the full sun, which can be quite strong in ancient India. And when the army came up against the Buddha, there's a kind of an ethic in India that you kind of respect monastics, people who live a religious life, so he was blocking their way. So they stopped, and the king who was leading the army went over to talk to him, and he said to the Buddha, why are you sitting meditating in the middle of the road when just over there there's a big tree with lots of shade? Maybe you should go over there and sit. And the Buddha said, I'm fine here because I sit under the shade of my people, of my fellow Shakyans. And so the king got the message that he was there to kind of protect his people or make an impression. And the king turned around and went home with his army, only later to come back and finish the job. So, it wasn't so the Buddha said the same verse to the king. At that time, Buddha said, "I'm sitting here under the shade of my citizens, my fellow people." And then he said to the king, "Hatred never ceases with hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth." And then there's not a story, but a last account is, I'm pretty confident, I can't tell you for sure, but that Martin Luther King also was aware of this verse. And in his own way, he paraphrased it in his tremendous dedication to not meeting hate with hate, but meeting hate with love. And if he didn't, I almost hope that he didn't get it from Buddhism, that teaching, because I think it's just a universal teaching. It's an ancient truth. It's something that makes a lot of sense to people. So this idea of hatred and meeting hatred with hatred versus meeting hatred with love, is it sensible to do that? Are we better protected by meeting hate with hate? We don't protect ourselves that way, because hatred destroys the person who hates. Hatred is a poison for the person who's hating. So, you know, do we want to live with that kind of poison? Do we want to live with that kind of burden of hate? Is it safe to put it down? Can we be protected and take care of ourselves if we don't have hate? Is it reasonable not to have hate? How do we not have hate in a way that's realistic? That doesn't mean we just kind of squash it down or repress it or pretend it's not there. And then, is there an alternative to hate? Is it love? How can love be an alternative? Love, compared to hate, is nourishing. Love, compared to hate, is supportive of some of the best qualities we have in ourselves. Hate supports some of the worst qualities in human being. So which would you rather have? Would you rather have that which is good in you come forth and be developed and grow? Or would you rather take that to chance that maybe what's good will come someday, but take your chances with an intention, a way of being, which is likely to bring out the worst in you? And that is a kind of a poison and very stressful. So, you know, what is your relationship to all this? How do you sit with all this? Is part of the process of practice, is part of the process of trying to explore and understand this so it becomes realistic for you. You don't want to just adopt in a policy that hatred never ceases with hatred, by love alone does it end, and then try to kind of force yourself into that. But I think it's a noble thing, it's a worthwhile thing, to really explore deeply in oneself what your relationship is to these kinds of verses, this kind of teaching. Does it work for you? Does it challenge you? How does it challenge you? Is it patently obvious, and so it's silly that we bring it up? It's child's verses. It's not obvious, it's actually ridiculous. And you can't stand hearing this anymore, because it seems so unrealistic that it just seems like an act of weakness, and somehow we'll be taken advantage of if we don't kind of counter hate with hate. We have to kind of hold our ground. So to grapple and explore, how is this for you? I think it's part of the process. Rather than having someone like me sitting up here and telling you what you should do with it, I think the part of the process of Buddhist practice is to hear ideas like this and then grapple with them, explore them, reflect on them, talk to friends about them. How does this live in you? What do you find? The other aspect of Buddhist practice is not to simply accept teachings like this, but rather to use your mindfulness and meditation and inner potential of self-reflection to really understand how these things work in you. How does hate, how does animosity, how does hostility operate in you? When does it come up? How do you relate to it? Do you have any freedom when it arises? Or do you feel a sense of compulsion that when you feel hostility to someone, that you kind of are, you know, you're on the conveyor belt, and you're just going to go along with it as long as it takes you. And it kind of eats away at you, and it kind of, you know, you're kind of working it and living with it. Or when you feel hostility, do you feel horrible and have, you know, really become, feel very full of guilt and full of shame, as if it's, you're not supposed to. Good Buddhists are not supposed to hate, so, you know, I better, you know, not let anybody know what I'm feeling. And so then, you know, the whole part of us gets pushed into the shadow or into kind of repressed. So the function of mindfulness is to take a very honest look at a very human tendency that I think most people have, and to really kind of get to the bottom and really stop and take a look and see what our relationship is to hate and hostility and animosity, see how it works, see when it's triggered, see how we buy into it, how we step back from it, see how we maybe and develop the capacity to look it right in the eye, to really see it clearly, unflinchingly. And the value of that is we can really see it that way, then the hope is that we're free of it. Not that it's gone away, but we're not in its grip. we're not caught by it. And if we're not in the grip of it, if we feel a certain degree of inner independence from movements inside of hate or hostility we might feel, then we have half a chance for wisdom to operate. We have half a chance to try to figure out what other ways might we want to be here. Now that I'm not caught in the grip of it, I have more choice. What choices do I want to live by? Do I want to just dive back into it because I think it's a good idea to hate? Or are there alternatives that I know? And what are those alternatives? And how strong are those alternatives in you? And what have you learned about how to come forth into the world with those alternatives? And one of those alternatives is love, a powerful movement. All religions that I know of, maybe cultures, I don't know if all cultures, but differentiate between a whole range of different kinds of love. You know, there's romantic love. You know, the famous way this is distinguished is in Greek language. You know, there's eros, kind of romantic or erotic love, and then there's philia, which is kind of friendly love, and then there's agape, which is this altruistic care and love for all beings. And so in Buddhism also there's that kind of distinction. And there is kind of erotic love and romantic love, which there's love which is self-centered, which has more to do with what we want than our love and care for the other person. And then there's more, I don't know if Buddhism uses the word altruistic, but there's more. There's love which is not selfish. And the four kinds that we champion in Buddhism is love, is loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And these are four beautiful qualities of heart. The first one is an intention and feeling of goodwill towards others. The compassion is a feeling, a desire to alleviate the suffering of others, somehow being tuned into suffering of others and motivated by it, caring for people. The third is to feel a certain kind of love that celebrates and rejoices in other people's good fortune, success, and happiness. And the fourth is a kind of love that where our heart is open, we're available to love people, we love them, we care for them, there's caring. But we also care for ourselves so that we don't get caught up in trying to do something for people that we can't help. There are times when it doesn't make sense to help people. It doesn't make sense to step forward when in their challenges and whatever. And so sometimes it's necessary to step back and not give up on the love, but have a certain kind of equanimity or non-reactivity that maybe is available in the future if there is something we need to do for them. So the idea of cultivating love, goodwill, cultivating caring for others, being able to see others as oneself, maybe, being able to put ourselves in other people's shoes sometimes to see what it's like, to imagine what their suffering and what their struggles are. What would it be like for you if you were in their shoes? A story that I've told sometimes which made a big impression on me. I mean, a story, it happened to me. I was in I was living in San Francisco in the corner of Haight and Laguna, Lower Haight, and I came out of my house one day. And there was this kind of old, I don't know, almost low-riding kind of clunky car that came screeching down the hill and screeched and turned and came to a full stop right in the intersection of Haight and Laguna. And out of the back seat of the car, there tumbled this woman. And out of the front seats tumbled these two big, big, strong guys. And I'm kind of tall, right? These guys were big. And I'm not much of a, you know, strong person, but these guys were strong. And they were after the woman. But she was stepping away. They were going to, so, you know, she was, I don't know, I don't remember anymore if she was screaming or what was going on, but it was, certainly it was a big conflict between these two big guys and this woman. And so I didn't know what to do. So not knowing what to do, I stepped in between the two of them, between the woman and the two guys. And so now they were advancing on me. And so they would take a step towards me, and I'd step back. That's all I could figure out to do. And they were saying something to me. I don't remember what they were saying, but I was like, what's gonna happen here? I was wondering what was going to happen. And then this other man came off the sidewalk and walked up to all of us, sitting right in the middle of the intersection, and he said this. He said, you know, if I was in her shoes, if I was in her situation, I hope that you would stop to find out what was going on for me. That's all he said. And everyone calmed down. And then there was a discussion, and seemingly the conflict came to an end. And I never found out what happened in the end, but that statement kind of calmed everything down. If this was happening to me, I hope you would stop and check it, you know, ask what's going on. So this ability to kind of imagine ourselves in others or others in ourselves is a powerful capacity of human being, kind of empathy or care or active imagination. And, you know, in some ways we share so much. In some ways, you know, the basic human instinct to feel like we belong, to feel respect, to have a place to feel safe in, to feel like we can walk in a way through our towns and cities and feel safe and connected and have friends, have family, have people care for ourselves, is a pretty profound human need and human capacity that I think we all share. So how can we find ways to have love be at the forefront? So that's what we meet with, that's an alternative. How can we do it so it's effective, so it's an effective counter towards hate? So one of the things that we do is to explore what love is, to explore how to love. And this is where, again, like something like meditation practice can be very helpful, mindfulness practice, because as we practice, one of the consequences of seeing clearly what's going on for us is that we start seeing all the things we do that's extra, that are not needed, the forces of the mind and heart that are painful to do, things like hate or greed or being caught up in fear, being caught up in our thoughts and our stories that we tell ourselves that kind of go on incessantly and paint a picture on everybody around us. And to allow the mind and the heart to settle, and some people talk about the heart and mind getting purified, getting cleansed of all the a lot of the conditioning that we have, a lot of the stories and ideas we have about what should happen and who other people are and who we are, cleansed of the ways in which we get tied up in our desires, our selfishness, tied up in our fears and our resistance and, you know, getting caught up in very strong feelings of us versus them. These are all activities of the mind that go on. And as we meditate and look deeply into our mind, these begin to settle away. They're kind of a cleansing. And then as we cleanse the surface kind of chatter of the mind, the surface, all these kind of more toxic kind of movements of the mind, they settle away peacefully. They settle away quietly. It's not like a war with ourselves to have these things. But as we feel, you know, more connected, more safe, more relaxed, these fall away. And then there's a chance for something to emerge. And a very important part of mindfulness practice is the allowing of something to emerge from within, rather than be us who's engineering and making something happen, wanting something to happen. And so that we say sometimes the Dharma begins to emerge in us. Dharma here being a deep inner process of transformation, of healing, of resolution of things. It's a beautiful thing. But one of the things that can emerge is love, a radiance of love, a tenderness of love, a gentleness of love, kind of a sense that love is not something we have to think about and kind of logically engineer and say, it's a good idea. I'll do the algorithms and try to figure out whether I should love right now. But rather, it's allowing some kind of tenderness or or resonance, or ability to feel other people, or appreciate other people, that's kind of can be innate when things fall away and settle away. And so to be able to be in touch with it, to feel that, to know that, becomes a tremendously important resource. So it's not an abstract idea to love, but we feel it as a strength. We feel it as a home. We feel it as something we feel is deeply good, and that this is how we want to live. And then the task, the difficult task, is to try to figure out, how do I do that? How do I live from love? How do I live from this compassion, this care, this tenderness, this gentleness, this beauty that we have inside? And I don't want to say that it's easy to learn to do it, but it makes a world of difference, a huge difference, that you make, that you've decided that you're more interested in love than you are in hostility. That you're not interested in reinforcing or living with hate or hostility anymore. Even though it might be there, you don't stand behind it anymore. But what you want to stand behind, what you want to stand on, is love. And even if you don't feel it always or have it always, that's the North Star. That's how you want to live your life. And so that just to make that decision creates a fork, creates a new direction, allows something new to begin happening. And it might take a long time to really find yourself stabilized or find access to love in the way that can meet hate with love. So I talked to someone today who was up at the San Francisco airport yesterday, not to catch a plane. And she said that there was a few thousand people there, and there were also riot police with helmets and visors and the whole stuff. And that people who were protesting, some of them were doing it in a very angry way, right up against the face of the visors. So they're making a point, but I wonder, is that really productive? How productive is that? How useful is it that way? Could there have been a way to be there at the airport to protest what was going on, but could it have been also be done with love? Could they also have been pressed up against the police officers and been there with love? Is that silly? What has lasting effect? What do you think that police officer goes home with if he sees someone's eyes and they love the police officer, and the police officer goes home to his or her family, versus the police officer standing there, has been ordered to be there, and someone's hating them, and you know, it's tremendous venom in their eyes looking at them. What do you think that police officer goes home to then? To his or her children, family, and neighborhood. What's that like? What kind of effect does that have on our society? What spreads out from there? What creates the greater good? What happens? So, have you memorized the verse yet? I'll do it again. Hatred never ceases through hatred. By love alone does it end. This is the ancient truth. Think we can do it together? So, hatred never ceases through hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So, keep that in your memory. Because a day might come that you'll need it. The day might come that you get to sit on the platform, that you get to sit on a stage, that you get to stand in front of someone who is filled with hate, and you'll have a chance to recite it. And perhaps you can change history, like the Sri Lankan foreign minister did in San Francisco in 1951. Isn't that nice? Nice piece of San Francisco history that this verse made such a big difference. So that's what was on my mind today. I hope that this gives you something to grapple with and consider. And it's almost better if you just simply don't agree with me, because that might not go very deep. But if you grapple with it and really kind of explore this, it might actually be more productive for all of us. So thank you for listening, and thank you if you reflect on this some more. I'd be very happy. Thank you.